On FM, digital and your mobile. Cambridge 105 Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
So we get better flavour because of the Fenn soil.
I've drunk more beer since I came here and bought my two barrels than I've ever done in my life before, I think.
I shouldn't have said almonds. They don't make it from almonds.
So you've got this big sticky mess when you start off.
Pizza pot pints.
My wife's cakes are selling at Hotcakes. Brilliant, thank you.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. Our thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours of music and mirth. And now it's our attempt to outdo him with an hour of food and fun involving Alan Alda, Dr. Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Benman.
Today we bring you another conversation about food with Tina Roche and Liz Young from Cambridge Cookery and Bistro talking to an apparently butt-naked Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern, which is opening in the University Arms Hotel on the 1st of August.
We hear from Jay Scrimshaw of Guerrilla Kitchen, who is starting up a new venture called Meatless.
But we're not meatless on flavour. We will be hearing from Mill Road Butchers. They're reopening after quite a lengthy refurbishment this very weekend.
And we hear from a local producer of Korean-style sauces, and Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments will be along to talk about jobs for June.
We'll also be bringing you updates from local food and drink tweets, what's available free on the Olio app, and Cambridge food and drink news too.
So, to begin, and I've been stalking Mill Road Butchers for the last few months, and with construction going on, I was waiting for the time to pounce. I caught up with managers Michael and Dan just the other day. They have been burning the midnight oil, making sure that everything is ready, and they have just opened in the last few hours. That's if you're listening to our live Saturday show. Michael and Dan have plenty of history with Mill Road Butchers, as they will tell you now.
Hi, I'm Mike, the head butcher at Mill Road Butchers in Cambridge. So my dad sent me to work in this shop when I was 12 years old.
Oh, yeah.
He was friends with Andrew Northup, the previous owner, and he thought it was a great idea to motivate me about working hard in school. There's been so many great butchers here over the years, and it's just bringing all of those little things together to bring the perfect service for our customers. Safe to say, 17 years later, here I am, taking over the very shop that I started working in. It's a really, really great honour for me.
Should we have a little guided tour through?
Sure. Yeah. So we've got a really great sausage-making room. All of our sausages are made with fresh ingredients and free-range pork. All our pork is Dingley Dell, which is an Essex breed. Really, really fantastic. Alimentum are using the same pork at the moment. If you're a big foodie, you'll know that restaurant. And then across here, we have our cooked room, which is still under construction, but we're going to have some ovens in here making our own scotch eggs, pork pies, sausage rolls, everything from scratch, everything with our own recipes, our own meat, and it's just making sure that we get a really, really fresh look on it, and all our cooked meat will be as we want it rather than buying in shop-made stuff.
What I want to point out here is the importance of you having separate rooms for these things.
Yeah, so, I mean, over the years, the rules and regulations around environmental health have changed. Food-borne illnesses are obviously sort of coming down because we're making sure that we keep everything separate. Our cooked meat room is just for cooked meat. No raw meat will go in there unless it's being cooked. And our sausage room will obviously be kept as is, and environmental health is happy with the way we're doing things.
Mm. Because like you say, a few years ago, before all the construction had started on this place, you weren't able to do your own sausage rolls and so on site.
Yeah, we had to buy everything in from a company called Barsby's in Peterborough, who are really great, and I've got nothing against them. But being able to cook them ourselves means we can change the flavours, we can really make the pastry lovely and fresh and crispy. It also means that we can do other things later on down the line.
So what we're looking at here is like two almost, they're almost like container style units. Everything is climate controlled and nothing comes out of here unless it's ready for sale on the shop.
Yes. We've got two walk-in fridges downstairs, I can show you.
I'll follow you.
Yeah.
Ah.
Good, right?
I haven't been in one of these for a while.
Yes. So we've got three walk-in fridges now. One is for our catering customers. So all the restaurants, the pubs, the cafes that we serve will all be in one. They use a very different style of meat to what we use in the shop. But in the other fridge, we're going to keep all of our shop stock.
Hmm.
And that's where the fun begins.
Uh-huh. It's so different. I used to work for a little supermarket.
Yeah.
This was donkey's years back, and I remember dodgy things happening, like my boss would come along in his Merc and he'd have pig carcasses in the boot that he'd just grab from another shop, throw these in the chiller now, barking at us.
Not anymore.
Oh yeah, that's lovely, it's pristine, eh?
Let me show you the shop fridge, which has got got a favourite cat then.
Because I remember Gary was talking about this to me back in... I was here in June 2015.
Right.
So he was going, oh, you know, these are our ambitions and we're hoping it's going to happen by next February or March. And it just massively increases your capacity, doesn't it?
100%. And, you know, it took a lot longer than expected. The business was sold, the premises were sold, and it's taken this long to finally get to a stage where we can close, we can get the new shop rebuilt, out the back's all new. I mean, it just means that we can really, really take things to the next level.
Yeah. So we're just stepping out now onto Devonshire Road. This isn't all you as well, is it?
No, we come back to this wall here. It's a little bit smaller than it used to be footprint-wise.
Yeah.
But the way it's been designed really opens up a lot more space inside.
So this is around the back of the shop front.
Yes. This is all going to be a display fridge. You know, our sort of more important customers can come around and have a look and see our beef hanging. We'll have ribs on a rack here aging. And it just means that we can get people to choose their perfect piece of meat. And really get an idea of what's going on here. This shop hasn't had bodies of beef for, I believe, 8 years.
Yeah.
So to get that back was my first priority. Getting really, really good, local, free-range, marbled beef. And there's nothing worse than lean beef, in my opinion. If you're a foodie, you'll understand that it's going to cook. It's going to have that really great nutty flavour. It's going to be really moist, really tender. That's what we're looking for. So this week we've got a sailor's beef, which is a French-inspired cow. It's been aging for 2.5 weeks in our supplier's fridge. And it's come to us, raised just next to the Sandringham estate in Norfolk.
Yeah.
So they've brought it down for us and it's really, really looking good. My lambs are off the salt marsh in Essex. And then again, we've got the Dingleydale pigs. So really, really happy with everything that's coming this week. Good covering of fat on the pork and the beef especially. The lamb we like a little bit leaner because it's a little bit oily.
Yeah.
But I'm really excited for people to take this stuff home, cook it and come back with great feedback.
The smell coming from here, emanating from here, is just gorgeous, succulent. I wish we could do smell-o-vision on radio. That is beautiful. Really beautiful.
I say, we've got 5 different types of sausages this weekend, from our Cumberlands, our Magez, our pork and apple, our Old Smokies, which are chilies, garlic with smoke flavouring, and then we've got Toulouse, which is red wine and garlic, just to bring a really nice balance of flavours and just to give our cabinet something sort of nice to look at.
Yeah.
I make over 150 different styles of sausages myself. Everyone else has got new ideas and we're constantly trying new things out and bringing sort of different flavours to the table, so it's really, really good.
Is a lot of that driven by, this sounds so cheesy for me to say, but like the international element of Cambridge? You've got so many different customers that you've got to cater for here.
Right, and especially on Mill Road, it's very cosmopolitan and I've always loved that about Mill Road.
Yeah.
You know, I spent the last couple of years out in Essex and it's very, very plain and mundane and everyone's very nice, but they're all very the same. And I just love this sort of vibrant community where everyone wants something different, and I've got to try and cater to 50 different people who all want different things. But if I can bring it all together in one fantastic sort of amalgamation of ideas, then suddenly you get a really good buzz. So that's the idea, you know. We're not going to please everyone because people are going to want lean meat, and unfortunately that's not going to be us to start off with, but you know, it's, we're hoping to be the best quality we can be.
Yes, yeah.
And it's really great that, you know, the old school butchery can still happen in Cambridge. It was a dying art for a long, long time. But we've got a lot of young guys coming into the trade now. We're certainly running at least 1, maybe 2 apprenticeship programs, trying to bring younger people in, teaching them the right way. Cutting up a body of beef is an old sort of technique that very few young butchers learn. So really teaching them the right way is the way forwards. And it's just going to keep that sort of buzz around butchery in Cambridge.
Because the last time I was here, I was speaking with Gary and one of his apprentices, Harriet. Has she moved on now?
Harriet moved back to London. She's actually coming back this weekend for our grand opening.
Brilliant.
So, a celebrity face. we were trying to get Kevin Tarbett and Martin Young and Andrew Northrop back in town, but unfortunately
Martin,
they all have to...
I forgot Martin.
Yeah, Martin Young, he's still around, so, you know, they want to come visit and see the new shop and see what's happened to the place, because every time we've driven past for the last 2 years, it's been in less than adequate state. So yeah, it's really exciting to see it finally looking pretty again.
You've got a really fantastic view of Mill Road here on both sides of the shop. Butchers are always very visual, aren't they?
Yeah,
you have the very cool shop displays, and that's something that Mr. Favish was big
absolutely
on.
So previously you had the marble in the window, which is, I mean, 60, 70 years ago, that's where the meat would have been displayed, on a marble slab in the window.
Yeah.
Obviously we can't do that anymore, it's a bit of a shame. But with these new windows, like you say, we're drawing so much attention from the street and we're getting just so much kind of eyes on us at all times.
Yeah.
So we can now present ourselves in the most immaculate way. Beautiful displays in the fridge at all times. As you can see, we've got a huge new servo cabinet here and it's just going to be full to the brim the whole time, enticing people off of the streets.
All right, Dan and Mike, thank you very much. Your voices will be on air as you're busy cutting and serving on Saturday afternoon.
Right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio.
The Mill Road Butchers is now up and running, and it will also be open on Sundays from 10 till 4pm. It's great to see them back again at the corner of the Mill Road Bridge. And if you are a regular Twitter user, you can follow them at Mill Road Butcher.
At one of the Cambridge events at Burwash Manor, I tried some of Kyung Lim's Korean sauces, which were fantastic, and I asked her what inspired her to produce them.
So my mother, she worked a lot when I was little. She always made like these elaborate meals for breakfast, and I always asked her, how are you able to make bibimbap or bulgogi for breakfast? Oh. And she said, the best way is to pre-batch the sauces. So she would make a lot of sauces during the weekend, and then she would make them for breakfast and dinner and so on and so forth. Ooh. And our bulgogi sauce was very popular at the house.
Bulgogi. House,
so. Yeah, okay. Bulgogi and the spicy yangnyeom sauce as well. And so that's how we started. And after many years, we thought, you know, after having a supper club in Cambridge and people have said, hey, you should make your sauces. How come that's not coming up? And after 2 years of testing, we decided, I think we're ready.
Why not? Exactly. Yeah. So you had a supper club? What was that called?
I did. It was called Kyum's. Then we had, in Kyum's, we had some Korean fried chicken, bibimbap, and a lot of the things that are really missed from home.
So you've got a lovely range of sauces. Can you tell me a bit more about each one?
Oh, yeah. Yes, of course. So I have a spicier soy version where it's very flavorful. It takes a long time to make, but it's that value that I add that sort of says, you know, you don't have to compromise with, you know, just a sweet sauce. This you can you can change it up a little bit, add more sugar if you wanted to, and it adds a lot of value and quality to your meals.
Mm. And so, this one is
I have this one.
Korean.
Yeah, the soy one, and that's really popular right now. As well as the spicier one on the side that has like chili peppers in it, the gochugaru in it.
And this is called. So, Kyum's Korean barbecue soy sauce.
All-purpose Korean barbecue soy sauce.
And I love the design on this.
Thank you. I made it myself.
what is the design of?
It's a reflection of a mountain in different colors.
It's beautiful. Really beautiful. And I love the from mother to daughter, the fact that you're referencing your heritage.
Yes, I'm very... Oftentimes when when we moved to Cambridge, I was very homesick. Mm. And this was a way to cure my homesickness. Mm. And then it was just easy to just for my mom to say, hey, just put in the soy sauce that we make, the soy barbecue sauce or the spicy sauce that we make, and just call it a meal. And it's true. It's really easy to replicate what she did with the sauces that I make here.
And these are probably not like any commercial sauces that you could buy.
Yeah, they're less sweeter. They're more. There's more added to it, and it's homemade. So. Mm. You can definitely enjoy these, I promise you.
And they've got a chili heat, but not
It's
too
not too
much.
Spicy. Yeah. Mm. It's very nice, and it's vegan friendly, so...
Excellent. And this other one here, you've got an asado, which is a spicy habanero.
So this is what I've been telling a lot of people who stop by here. They're like, why do you have Argentina and Korean sauces? Well, I'm Korean-American. But I also grew up in Argentina for 6 years when I was little. So this is like a flavor memory of mine from there.
That's really, really nice. And your other asado ones are medium
spicy, which has a hint of cayenne pepper. And the mild one doesn't have any chili peppers. But we also have a very spicy one, which is a habanero. And that has a kick of habanero. We like the heat of habanero because it's very clean. And you can still taste the herbs and the spices that we put in it.
Mm-hmm. It seems like they've all been going pretty well, but particularly your barbecue soy sauce.
I know. Yeah. I need to start making more of those, but it does take a lot of time, but it's definitely worth it. If I can make it easier for you, then I'm more than happy to.
And also, can you buy online, or where can you get these?
For right now, the Korean sauces aren't available in the shops, but yes, definitely you can buy them online. But the asado sauces are available at Arjuna, The Daily Bread, Hissin Chop Shop, Burwash Larder, Kofco, Cambridge Organic Food Company, and Country Kitchen. They're all very, very good people that I work with. I really love them. I send them chocolates for Christmas. They're really great people.
Oh, that's nice. I mean, that's one of the nicest things about the Cambridge food scene. Everyone's friendly, everyone's supportive.
It is. Everyone's very welcoming. So yeah. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. And you've got recipes and information on www.kyums.com.
KYUMS.com. And right now I am in the process of uploading recipes, but I do have some things that I've made in the past there, because not only did I do supper clubs, but I also opened my kitchen window to offer takeaways for my neighbors. Unfortunately, that's I'm no longer doing that, but it was a good experience to do that for 1 year, and you can see what I've made from that experience in my website.
Fantastic.
KYUMS.com.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a delightful product, and I'm buying one now.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You were impressed then, Sue.
Indeed I was. And in fact, I had some of the Korean barbecue sauce last night with some tuna. Really, really nice.
All right, I'm going to get some.
Yes, worth getting.
Now, one of our regular features on flavour at the moment involves Tina Roche and Liz Young. They are the co-owners of the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro on Hills Road. Now, in this feature, Tina and Liz invite a guest chef or a food expert in to have a chat about their lives, what got them started in cookery, and generally compare old war stories. Their guest this time around is the effortlessly talented Tristan Welch, who is gearing up for the imminent opening of Parker's Tavern on Regent Street.
I love doing radio because you don't have to wear any clothes.
Well, we appreciate it too.
Well, we are Swedish, aren't we?
Do you feel that it's a calm before the storm at the moment then?
We have a full team on standby. They're chomping at the bit. So it's really exciting and great to see such young enthusiasm ready to start cooking.
I'm sure all of Cambridge is looking forward to it because it is such an iconic location that was looking rather sad for many years. So Regent Street, isn't it, is developing nicely and a few changes for the better.
I can see a transformation of Regent Street right now, which is super exciting.
But then you are a local boy, actually, so you are sort of returning home, aren't you?
Yep, I'm from just outside Cambridge, and Cambridge is where it really started for me, actually. My first job was working for Gay Roads in London.
Oh, I see. Tell us.
And he was on tour, and he did a date at the Corn Exchange. Like a groupie, I was a young college student in those days. I hung around and I wanted his autograph. I got a bit of an expose. I can tell you how he kept that hair.
Oh, we'd love to know.
Would you like to know?
Yes, please.
Weller hair gel.
Well, and did he have a personality to match that spikiness, which I felt sometimes came across on television?
Gay Rhodes is good fun. He's a dear friend. He lives in Dubai now, actually. And actually, a really, really sort of poignant points in my career, Gay Rhodes just turned up. So it's been really lovely.
So you sort of talked your way into your first job, did you, with him?
Yeah, I did. So I asked for his autograph and then I said, can I have a job, please? So he said, here's a number to my kitchen, here's a number for my head chef, give him a call and see where it goes. And his head chef said, oh, could you wait a month? And then so I called back and I called back. And I kept on calling once a month for about 3-4 months and eventually said, why didn't you come and have a look?
Brilliant.
And I went and did a day's trial. And I fell in love with it instantly. He offered me a job and that was it. I think I was 17 years old and off on my way to London. And that's how it all started.
Persistency gets you there, though, doesn't it? Just ringing, nagging, yes, in a way, in a nice way.
That's what I tell my wife, yes.
Yeah.
Was that how you started out, then, Liz?
No,
did you nag your way into your kitchen?
Well, certain places, yeah, definitely. Well, not nag. I think nag's probably the incorrect word to use, but definitely consistency on phone calls. And I think they just think, oh, for God's sake, will you just come in?
I'll give up.
In a way, yeah.
Shut up.
Just
come in. If you're passionate
about something...
But
you're keen.
And if you're passionate about something, if you love it, you don't even realise you're being persistent. You're just... I think that's a lot of my career. I'm just doing what feels right and what I feel comfortable doing.
And then from there, you moved on to Le Gavroche. Is that straight after Gary Rhodes?
Gosh, I did, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's quite a step up.
Well, I heard when I was working for Gary Rhodes that all the best chefs work for the Roux family.
Yes.
And I was like, I really want to be one of the best chefs. And
Le Gavroche was such an iconic restaurant, wasn't it? Particularly, you know, sort of 15, 20 years ago when there was so little competition and they were just the place to eat.
Absolute institution. So who was I working there with when I was there? Monica Galletti.
Oh.
She was on the canapé section when I was on the fish. Bryn Williams.
Uh-huh.
Who I think is just opening up at Somerset House as well, I believe.
And so was it an amazing experience? It's such pure classic French cooking.
incredibly hard work, incredibly rewarding. You learnt to love it because as a young lad, it's really, really daunting and quite scary, I think. I look back on those days now with complete fondness and I was well in there, you know. I was part of the family by the time I left. I think I was almost 4 years there. Mm-hmm. One of the most amazing things happened to me there is when Chef Michel Roux sent me to see his father. It's a big wood panelled office, the desks floating in the middle of the room.
Yes.
And Albert Roux, sit down here, boy. And he passes me three guidebooks and he says, choose where you'd like to go next. My son says you're doing very well, and that was it.
So,
and he said, come back and see me in a couple of weeks. And I did, and I reviewed these books, and I was, oh, my God, I'm in here anywhere, crikey. And I chose Arpège in Paris, which was an amazing time. And Albert Roux packed me off to Paris with a little letter that roughly translates, says, here's a little bird that I've kept under my wing for some time. Would you mind keeping him under yours for a little while?
And it was such a sweet letter. How was that,
but being a young chef, you're like, yeah. Oh, God, I'm not a bird. I mean, it's ridiculous.
So landing in Paris, at another such an iconic restaurant, with his blessing, you must have felt pretty special.
Yeah, but the French have a way of knocking that out of you quite quickly. And before I knew it, I was at roast beef.
Of course.
And then you're back to square one, and you have to earn your stripes again. So scrubbing the floors, peeling the vegetables, and all this sort of stuff.
But how long were you there?
A year and a half, and I grafted because there was no way I was leaving that as a floor scrubber because I was a Roux Brothers trained chef. I was really proud of that.
I mean, yes, you must have gritted your teeth a bit there.
All right, I'm dramatising. I wasn't always scrubbing the floor, but I was there when the restaurant turned from a restaurant serving meat to a vegetarian restaurant.
Yes.
And it was the first 3-star Michelin vegetarian restaurant ever.
Yes. It caused such a stir.
And yeah, it was amazing to see and witness. I mean, I was running the veg section at the time, my life got very busy.
I can imagine. Oh, amazing. I mean, it was such a drastic thing to do then, and for a restaurant of that standard. But they changed again, didn't they, to be vegetable-led, but still offering some...
Slowly integrated it back. Yes. We put the pigeon came back on the menu because customers were requesting it, and then a chicken that was reared... like it would have been reared in the 15th century or something like that.
He's obviously an incredibly singular man.
I've never seen someone smoke a cigar and cooking in the kitchen at the same time, but he manages to put it off quite well. A real character. And I never forget the day when we made that drastic change from serving meat to not. It was halfway through a service or maybe just in the beginning of a lunch service. Alain Passard came in and said...
he just declared it like that?
Just like that.
There wasn't a lead-up to it?
No. We had customers in the restaurant ordering...
Meat,
my goodness. So at the time, there was a tête de veau on it, and we used to poach a whole veal head, and then we knocked the top of the veal head out and took the brains out and chopped them and mixed it with lemon and cumin and sewed up the head and then poached it, and then we'd char-grill this giant calf's head.
My goodness.
And then you'd serve these little slices and stuff like that. So that was one of the things. The pigeon was there as well. And I think it was around the time with the foot and mouth disease and the BSC and all that sort of stuff. And he just came and said, no, pas de tout. But chef, no, fairly legume. Do the vegetables. Okay.
But an amazing push forward.
I didn't have a lot of vegetables. I wasn't ready for this.
Carrots and beans.
Buttered carrots all round. No, we used to do something called couscous de legume, which was like loads of different veggies with just couscous on. And it was incredibly simple to eat, complicated to prepare, because there were 30, 40 different elements to it that would just change with the seasons, with the markets. And it was that.
But maybe a good thing that he just was an absolute game changer in that respect, and then he's gone back to something that is still much sort of plant driven.
The man looks at vegetables in a completely different way, which is just breathtaking and something we should all take from, actually.
Yes. So what has inspired you then, apart from obviously being a keen young man at 16 thinking that going into the kitchen could be fun?
The game changing element was when I was at secondary school and we had to do home ec classes, so we were cooking, and it was just creating something, bringing it home, and my mother would be overjoyed. She would really enjoy it. So what I was doing was making people happy. So I could make something that I really affect in a positive way, and then it has a great effect on other people.
Making people happy with the food.
Yeah. And, you know, the girls loved it. Brilliant. And the ratio of boys to girls was brilliant as well. So you have tons of girlfriends.
Excellent. Well, they're very good reasons.
And having a great time. I mean, I'm joking, but I mean, the serious element was I really enjoyed the cooking element, and it was something I was struggling in other certain areas of school. This was something that really related to me and something that I could have a really positive effect.
You already came from a home with really good food, obviously, and a curious attitude to food, presumably, and it sounds like you were exposed to eating a lot of different foods than if they had their own allotment. And
absolutely, yep, definitely, which was a struggle in the beginning because I was a really fussy eater.
Tell us more.
So I just refused to eat everything. I was very, very fussy. But I think it changed when I started cooking for myself. My palate matured, I matured, my senses became alive when I started connecting with cookery, and I could taste things maybe that affects that, and that affects this. And I started to respect things for what they actually were, then rather than just sustenance. I started seeing food as a pleasure. Mm-hmm. And that's when it all changed, I think, yeah.
So you spent some time in Sweden. Was that a happy time?
It was a sabbatical.
Where were you in London when you stepped away?
I was chef patron of Launceston Place, which I'd had 4 years.
Yeah.
I was at the height of my career at that point. Yeah. Spending what we thought would be a year in Sweden was amazing, but we had such a wonderful time. And I made so many friends out there, and living life as a bum, the bubble burst, I ran out of money.
Yes, that does tend to happen in the end. So you had to go back to work somewhere.
Yeah. And so we started the process of getting back in contact with my contacts in London, and we found a site, and it was all getting quite exciting. Randomly on LinkedIn, someone contacted me and said, "Hey, how do you feel about the Caribbean?"
Did you have to think long about that?
The first time I said, no, thanks. And I just cheekily said, "Hey, I'll tell you what, send me out for a week and I'll have a look." And they replied saying, "Hey, how about next week?" And I was like, okay. I was cooking on a beach cafe, and the fisherman would come in with a fish, and I would grill it and cook it.
Well, there is that lovely photo of you, coming out of the AC Blue Sea with a sort of harpoon and a fish in a sort of best James Bond style, I would say. Yeah. Is that what it was like all the time?
That was my life, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was beautiful. Sundays were amazing, you know, because we'd spend Sundays on the beach. But Monday to Saturday was very hard.
So what made you say that from, you know, the career you describe in London, which was obviously hugely pressurised and high profile, this was tougher in some ways?
Well, yeah, so everyone works on island time. The local people are amazing, but they're just not the kind of chefs and hospitality staff that work in London. And you've got a clientele coming from very high profile pop stars and all this sort of what have you, expecting a certain level. And I thought, oh, Tristan's here now. Okay, great. Here I am with my rapper, gardener, plumber, and we're going to cook for these guys. And so you kind of make your own team sort of thing. And so the biggest challenge I had is how do you motivate people that are here for the rest of their lives, and it's very difficult for them to get a visa anywhere else. I thought, well, the first thing these people need is prospects, a career path. And we built up from square one. And it was very, very gratifying, but my goodness, was it tough in the beginning. Mm. So my back was against the wall because you just couldn't get anyone to bring anything to the level that people would expect. And from there, when you're in a right corner and the team's in another corner, you have nowhere else to turn but say, all right, guys, what do you need? Well, you need a job for life that you can grow to and hopefully one day be able to afford a house or something like that. Okay, so if we do give you this experience here, and build it up. And I think one of the things was is as simple as giving people a good uniform to wear, and all of a sudden that brings them up, because you're starting with really raw skills, and in the end they did really well, you know. So what I did, I started buying produce from their cousins or their uncles. Yes. So the local people actually had a relationship to what they were cooking, and the more they served, the more happy their uncle was when they got back to their home. And so what I did is just increased the family.
It couldn't have been more different then from your London life.
Totally changed my outlook on life, on people, and the investment that you need to put in on them, because, you know, I was one of Gordon Ramsay's ex-chefs.
Yes,
you know,
yes, so, yes. So it gave you a more holistic view, perhaps, of your staff, but it must also have done something quite drastic to your cooking then, because you had these amazing produce around you, and yet there was a limit to how much you could produce because you didn't have a massive kitchen full of excellent chefs to do what they can. How did that affect your own cooking then when you came back to the world of plenty and skill?
Well, the wonderful thing about cooking out there is you focus on the core values. So you've got amazing fresh fish. I mean, the tomatoes out there are amazing. So fish, tomatoes, coconut. Great! And that's a delicious dish. So we would just build up like that. But I think the most drastic effect it had on me was hair loss.
Or surely not. So now that you're back in Cambridge, will the obviously the London years, but also the stint in Sweden, the couple of years working in the Caribbean, will that influence your menu at all, do you think? If not directly, indirectly?
I know the menu is going to be full with all of those things, hints and twists. And I think that's going to be one of the wonderful things of Parker's Tavern. It tells a little story. It's not the Tristan show. It's Parker's Tavern. But there's these little things. So water coconuts are going to be on the menu just because I think it's wonderful. And the lightness of a cured fish and things like that. Like for instance, yes, our smoked salmon. We're not doing smoked salmon, we're doing smoked trout.
And so are we.
Yes,
we're buying Hampshire chalk stream trout. We're very keen on our sustainability as well, as you know. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't bear the thought of what the salmon had endured. It's not a sustainable fish, and unless you're buying wild salmon, it's a hopeless quest, really. So we're just taking on a Hampshire river stream. So it's farmed, but they are moving upstream, they're moving naturally. It's a beautiful muscular fish, absolutely delicious, and it's on instead of the salmon, so we have completely taken smoked salmon off.
It's fed through the stream as well, yes, so there's not a fish meal that
no,
goes
that's right, yeah, no, that's so right. As close to natural as you can get, so we are incredibly pleased, and the comments have been fantastic because it just tastes like the best smoked salmon you've ever had.
So yes, you're all going for what it used to taste like, and this is why sustainability is so key, because if we don't do these things responsibly, and restaurants are not going to be the same in 10 years, and the things that we've fallen in love with won't be as good. And you can tell that with smoked salmon already. Smoked salmon is ghastly a lot of the time. Nope, yes, there are smoked salmons available, but it's missing the edge of what you used to have 15 years ago or something like that. And I sound like an old codger now. But
no, I mean, we feel it very strongly here. You know, we're a small independent business, and we're very proud. We just got our silver award from Cambridge Sustainable, and we're going to go for the gold next year.
Well, in fact, it's weighing me down, isn't it?
Stooping slightly.
I wish I had one. It helped cover me up a bit.
One day you will too.
I sincerely hope so, because it's a very proud thing to have, especially for being an independent, because there's so many challenges about being an independent. Maybe the people that should be doing it aren't, and the people that probably can't afford to do it are.
And where have you recruited most of your chefs from? Locally?
The army.
Well, that will fit in well, then.
Bloody ruthless lot.
Exactly.
What we've done, we've got our staff house and offering people an above average wage for the hospitality industry, the fair right share of tips, which goes across the board.
We do that here as well.
I remember I did that pop-up with Alex and you gave me some cash.
Absolutely, you looked like you needed it. You were out of a job.
Yeah, well, I had no clothes on.
Yeah, exactly. We thought, clothe yourself quickly.
Absolutely, it should be fair.
I was a happy day. I haven't had tips in ages. Crikey. Didn't last long.
And what about accommodation in Cambridge then? Because that's a chronic issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's obviously a very expensive place to live, and unless you're earning an awful lot of money, it can be very difficult to live in, or let alone, you know, even anywhere near enough Cambridge to commute comfortably.
So there's a massive social responsibility that we need to take on, and I think it's bigger and way more political than I think I will ever be. But the problem we have is, if we want a nice place to sit and eat and enjoy, it comes a massive cost. Yes. And these people that are dedicating their lives or a proportion of their life to making this happen are not paid enough to afford a place in Cambridge. They're not paid enough to rent a place in Cambridge, yeah, or anything like that, especially not on the first run. I mean, so all of our pay structures are career-based, so there is a path to earning enough money so you can afford a flat or an apartment or something like that. I remember when I moved to London, I was young. My parents must have been crazy to let me go. I was 17. If it wasn't for them housing me in London, I would never have had this career I've had today.
That just shows how drastic the actions need to be to actually create a staff house. Otherwise, you presumably could not have recruited the many staff that you need.
We are hoping we're going to be a big restaurant. We've got enough seats anyway. With that comes the responsibility of taking that step, because it's something that not many restaurants could afford.
No.
And we're not certain we can afford it, to be honest, but we feel it's the right thing to do.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you so much, Tristan, for joining us, because I know that this is a tense period for you, and you have a million and one other things to do, but it's been lovely to chat to you and have you back after your pop-up here with Alex. And I think you can put your clothes back on now.
Thank you, although I'd choose not to.
That was Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern talking with Tina Roche and Liz Young of the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro, which is situated just off Hills Road. And next time, they will be chatting with Sam and Alex of Restaurant 22, and that has been gaining plaudits from all and sundry since it opened in March. You'll be able to hear that one in two episodes' time. And there's the music signalling the latest food tweets from the city.
Yeah, well, actually, this one came in last night, a tweet from Robinson College. They've got an evening of English wine and British food coming up. We'll give you the dates in the news section at the end. And if you're interested, have a look at their tweet, because there's a link there to the menu, which looks extremely good. Cambridge Sustainable Food have tweeted they're looking for a staff intern 3 days a week beginning July and November. Within the Cambridge Food Poverty Alliance, and details of that are at cambridgesustainablefood.org. There's been a lot of tweeting about the death of Anthony Bourdain, which I think we're all very sorry to hear, particularly the circumstances of it. Calverley's have tweeted they've got Neapolitan street food at their brewery all day today. They started that Saturday. They started at noon. Slightly reduced beer offer while they're upgrading the brewery. And, well, there's been some jobs tweeted and more about that in the news section at the end. Jay Scrimshaw is a much appreciated part of the Cambridge street food scene. His Gorilla Kitchen is a real favourite, and it went down incredibly well at the Eat Cambridge event at Steak and Honours Place in Wheeler Street last weekend. Now he's opening a second food truck called Meatless, and he popped into our Gwydir Street studios to tell me about it and about the free tastings on offer for everyone this very weekend.
If we were to think about the awesome food of Wandering Yak and then take Meat Liquor, the burger chain, and then put us in the middle, that's where we are. So we're going to be delivering plant-powered-based food, but giving it that meat, dirty edge too for the street food. So taking that dirtiness from as Meat Liquor and then the vegetarian and putting it together. And that's where we're going to be. We're going to be in the middle. So we're going for that sort of vegetarian, flexitarian market. Flexitarianism is quite a big thing at the moment. You know, people choosing not to eat as much meat, you know, Meatless Monday and so on. Yeah, I do this, my family, we do the same, try not to eat as much meat. Vegetarian food can be a bit bland sometimes, or it can be lack of texture. So this is all going to be about pumping flavour into and lots of texture.
Right, give us some examples then.
So we've been practicing with different things. So we've got like a slow cooked short rib. So it's going to be like a short rib of beef. So it's grilled to get loads of the caramelization and the charcoal, and then it's slow cooked in the oven in all the sort of the smoky tomatoes and chilies and all them sort of aromats that you might put in a beef recognized dish. It's treated exactly the same. What takes the place of the beef? So vital wheat gluten is a product used for meat substitutes, which they wash off flour and you're left with gluten. And then delivering vegetables, so like king oyster mushrooms, jackfruit, all these. So king oyster mushrooms especially we use in the beef because they give that meaty flavour. Yeah, and also when you was to roast a king oyster mushroom, it shreds up like it has the same structure as meat. So when you like imagine pulling a piece of pork or thing, it comes off strands like that. And you lay that into it, build it up, but you're making that piece of meat.
So you've still got the pleasure of the texture.
So you've got the texture of the meat. You've got a sort of a flavour of the meat, you know. And you've got that sort of, well, I'm not eating meat as well, you know. So. Yeah.
So you've had to do a lot of research for this, or what?
Yeah, no, I've been doing a lot of practicing over the last few months at home. So the kids have eaten a lot of experiments.
And have they enjoyed the experiments?
Not all of them. Experimentation, reading. You know, I mean, I'm a chef by trade. You know, we've got Gorilla Kitchen. That's all cool. But I wanted to do something that's a bit more challenging, maybe using a bit more technical, so I've got to think a little bit more, you know, think about what's going to create that texture that we take for granted from a piece of meat, you know.
So you're going to have to get more staff then?
We have more staff. We've just employed 3 more members of staff.
Because they're not easy to find.
Staffing is always an issue within the hospitality industry, always. Yeah, and key members of staff as well. You know, you've got to find, you know, I don't need all chefs. But we just need people who are passionate, want to know, and just want to have fun. Because it is, it's not sitting in a restaurant or cooking in a kitchen in a restaurant or working at front of house. It's, you know, you're different places, different people, interaction, you know, it's
Tell us
a lot of fun.
About the launch, when and where.
Okay, so we've got a launch party this Sunday, so the 10th at the Cambridge Distillery. which is a gin lab there in Grantchester. Starts at 12 until 3. There'll be gin cocktails, which unfortunately you'd have to pay for. But we've got some gin on offer. So now they do some like Japanese gins as well. So they'll be sort of infused with different, you know, spices and stuff like that. So that'll be really funky. Got a DJ there. So it'll be a bit of a party vibe. Sort of hopefully Grantchester will be nice and sunny. You know, just rock up for a bit of free food. It's all free, little tasters of everything.
That's very good. That's very generous. And when you are actually up and running permanently, have you got any established bookings?
Yeah, we're still working it out now. So we'll, as of sort of mid-June, we'll be at Food Park on a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We have a regular pitch at Thirsty in Cambridge on a Tuesday for Guerrilla Kitchen. So what we'll be doing is alternating them by the week. Alternating there. Oh, on Wednesday, we're in Shelford, Great Shelford, the Memorial Hall. So Guerrilla Kitchen is there every week now, has been for the last month. So we're going to alternate. So the two regular pitches, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're going to alternate. And then the weekends, I mean, the summer, it's already, but the Meatless is already booked up for different events throughout the summer and stuff.
Yeah. So, available for private hire?
Available for private hire, weddings, all that sort of stuff. And then obviously, probably next year, we'll hit all the festivals because I imagine the festivals after this year will be going, trying to go Meatless.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
so
great. Good. Okay, well, good luck with it.
All right, thank you very much.
If you're listening to our Sunday repeat, you'll have just enough time to go and enjoy some of those samples. At the Cambridge Gin Distillery in Grantchester, it stops at 3 p.m.
And here's some news of the free food available now in Cambridge, which you can find on the Olio app. Sarah on Rustat Road, which sits between Mill Road and Cherry Hinton Road, is offering two free parsnips. And Xenia over at the junction between Castle Street and Cambridge Road, she's got some co-op ham available for free, best before 10th of July. But we've got some more to tell you about Olio. Alan?
Yeah, I think Saturdays aren't the best day for looking at Olio. Mm. During the week, companies like Pret, for example, give away all of their unsold food, so all their sandwiches and various other things. And I certainly one person who regular listeners to Flavour will know, Susanna Watson, a.k.a. Hum Closen, is one of these one of the Olio people, food heroes, who goes and picks up all of Pret's unsold food on, I'm not sure if she does it on Tuesdays or Wednesday, and she posts it on Olio, but there's somebody every day who does that. So it's worth looking out during the week for what's on Olio.
Okay. Well, with summer being here and the longest day fast approaching, there is plenty to do if you're a grower of fruit and veg, I would have thought. Earlier in the week, Alan went along to Trumpington Allotments to find out from Dave Fox about jobs for June.
Right, Dave, a busy time of year. What sort of things need to be done?
Everything, really. Yeah, it's a crazy time of year, Alan, because we're nearly at the longest day. We've had a good spell of warm weather. It's actually cooler today. Maybe the prospect of some rain, that would be good. But yeah, almost everything in the garden is doing at the moment. And I mean, I spend a lot of time at the allotment, and even I find it difficult to pack everything in. And so, for example, seedlings that I've been nurturing for 6 weeks suddenly starting to look neglected, pot bound, and it's really time to get them in the ground. But also, if you're going to be sowing cucurbits outside, so pumpkins, squash, courgettes, cucumbers, it's really now to get the seed in during the next week or so. So that's getting to be a bit urgent. You've got a little bit longer for beans and so on, but then the salads, you don't want to be sowing them too late because they tend not to sell, lettuce and so on tend not to do too well in the summer, in the hot dry period, and they don't germinate anyway when it's above 21 degrees or something. So there's quite a few things need doing in the next week or so.
Right, okay.
So shall we go and do some of those things?
I think we ought.
So I've got some tomatoes to plant. So let's go and do that.
Yes, good. I'm getting quite anxious.
Sure, I can remember. But anyway, this bed's been under a thick hay mulch for a couple of months, and I'm now lifting most of that off so I can dig some planting holes and get the tomatoes in. And also, of course, I'm just checking for slugs and snails, which may have been hiding underneath this hay. Will just go on the compost heap now. It's a characteristic of the system I use. So leaving mulch on beds in general when there's no crop in there, but of course at this time of year We've got crops in almost every bed, so that means that the surplus mulch needs to go somewhere else, and that's the compost heap. Nice thing about this time of year with composting is that I can take this material, which is dry, brown, so relatively high carbon, not a lot of nitrogen in, and then I can mix that in with grass clippings, because there's plenty. In fact, we can hear a lawnmower in the background now. Hopefully, with any luck, that's one of the neighbours who brings me the bag of grass clippings and leaves it by my gate, and all clean biomass gratefully received.
So the presence of the mulch has kept the weed growth.
Yes,
down,
there's no seeds
off.
No weeds at all. No. Yeah. So having cleared the mulch, I'm planning on putting three rows of tomatoes in here. I've got 24 seedlings, so eight in a row. I've got a party of school children visiting tomorrow, so I'm just thinking about which ones they're going to plant and which ones I'm going to plant. So I'm going to put one in here. So it's making a fairly big hole with the trowel. A spade would be better, but don't have that right here, so we're using a trowel. And then into that hole I'm going to mix a little bit of manure. Old compost is good, fertilizers are good, cut comfrey leaves is good. Actually, there's an idea, comfrey leaves, that's what I'll use. Nice big hole, and then into that goes some of this comfrey, which I cut a few days ago, so it's wilting.
And that will add a lot of nutrients, presumably.
Yeah, add a bit. Also, moisture retentive material. This will help. As I say, anything which is going to provide fertility and moisture retention. That's what the tomato is going to want. Then mix the leaves in with a bit of soil.
And do the leaves have to be dead?
Well, they just take up less space that way. Mm. It's just harder to make a, you know, reasonably firm planting hold if the leaves are fresh. So this is a variety of bush tomato. It's a bush tomato. It's red alert. So the great thing about bush tomatoes is that you can plant them, mulch them up, and that's it. That's all you need to do for a crop. You don't have to stake them. You don't have to tie them, because they'll spread along the ground. They make side shoots, but they sort of stop themselves and produce fruit. Whereas a cordon tomato that needs training, you take the side shoots out as well. So there's much less work overall with bush tomatoes. The downside, of course, is that they're vulnerable to ground-living pests, so slugs and snails. So I'm just firming in around the tomato. And there we are, job done, leaving a slight depression around the stem so that water collects there and feeds the roots.
Found that.
Yeah. So this is a bed of broad beans, which I started harvesting a couple of days ago, and they've been superb. There is some black fly, so, you know, we always talk about black fly and broad beans almost in the same breath, don't we? But that's because when it's hot and dry at the end of May, the black fly are usually trying quite hard. You can see some there. So that's a plant which the top has been taken out to remove the most vulnerable part of the plant, but we've still got some black fly in the next section, so I'll nip that out over that side.
Is that a ladybird?
Yeah, that's right. And as soon as you see one, you see two, three, yes, four, five, yeah. Six, 20 more. So there's lots of ladybirds here. So that's great, because that means that the predator-prey relationship is evening itself out. And from now on, I'm not too worried about black fly on the beans, because obviously we want the ladybird to do well. And their larva in particular will be gobbling up the black fly. They eat huge numbers. So anyway, the next crop to go in this bed is overwintering brassicas, and I've got some quite nice purple sprouting broccoli seedlings which have been hanging around wanting to go in the ground. They've almost formed a delegation and come to demand to be planted out, so we're going to do that. But we have to, because my rotation doesn't always work according to schedule, or sometimes I bring on my seedlings too early, I'm actually planting some of these purple sprouting broccoli seedlings in amongst the broad beans before the broad beans are finished. So that's a slightly delicate operation, but it's quite feasible. And, you know, it might even have some advantages. I'm hoping that the pigeons won't find my broccoli seedlings because of the broad bean plant. I mean, maybe the pigeons are just watching and waiting and laughing as they hear this, but with any luck, the broad beans will disguise the location of the broccoli a little bit. So I'm just being slightly careful. I've just found a space between the... I've got two double rows of broad beans in this bed, so the brassicas are going in the middle. That's actually worked out quite well, so note to self, actually, there. two double rows of broad beans in a bed leaves enough space for overwintering brassicas. Nice deep hole for brassicas. We want to bury them a little deeper than they are already. I want to have a nice sturdy plant growing up above the soil. You can see it's not actually that root bound, not as bad as I'd feared. But in it goes. With brassicas, I normally would advise treading in around the seedling to really firm it in.
Are they like cabbages? Do they need really firm
Absolutely,
soil?
Yeah, firmer the better, because the wind at any stage when the plant is large with leaves on, it suddenly becomes very vulnerable to wind, you know. Mm. And don't forget, although it's a relatively simple thing to grow, it's a slightly different cropping. It's how long is it? It's going to be, it's another 9-10 months before this crops. Mm. So we've got to protect it all that time.
And what about nutrients? Will there be... obviously, the beans are putting nitrogen into the soil, but aren't brassicas quite nutrient-hungry?
Yeah, they're moderate feeders, but there's plenty of time to add some feed, add a mulch to that, so I'm not too worried about that. It would have been quite difficult to make a big planting hole and make a planting mix in there just because of the accessibility at the moment. Yeah, ideally, I would have done that, but yeah. Oh, here's we can have a quick look at the asparagus while we're here.
And you put down this quite recently, didn't you?
So in here we've got a mixture of mature asparagus plants, which I've been harvesting and I'm going to leave now. Or might take a few more spears, one last meal. And also quite a lot of new asparagus, which isn't yet established. And they've got flowers now, but also they've got these dark, unpleasant things, and these are the larva of the asparagus beetle. So I will spend far too long today removing... Oh, and these are the eggs as well. Little egg there. Can you see against the...
Yep.
That's my finger. Yeah, so they're quite hard to remove without damaging the foliage. And the main message I wanted to get across today, really, it was an awful lot to do in the garden, and seedlings need to go out, and it's the last chance saloon for sowing quite a lot of things over the next couple of weeks. And think, if you feel yourself really pressed and too busy and you can't fit it in this year, the lesson to be learned is, why not just book off the last week of May and the first week of June next year? That's your holiday. And if the weather, weather in the last few days, it's felt like being on holiday. So who would want to be anywhere else than Trumpington Allotments, Alan?
Dave Fox there from Trumpington Allotments. And Alan will be back in a few minutes with news of a plot swap there this weekend.
And once more, there is Green Onions signalling the start of our news section, and we begin with jobs.
Yes, we do. Don Pasquale in Market Square here in Cambridge is looking for waiting staff. Experience is preferred, but full training will be given. Email your CV to info@donpasquale.co.uk and you can pop in for an informal chat too.
Al Kasba in Mill Road has vacancies for part-time waiting staff and also a grill chef. Apply by calling in. The Plough and Coton is looking for a sous chef. Pop in for details. Also, Look Tie at the Cricketers, Central Cambridge, Melbourne Place, is looking for washing up and bar staff. Contact Noi at officelooktie@gmail.com or just pop in.
And Steak and Honour are looking for front-of-house staff and chefs. You can inquire at their Wheeler Street restaurants and Arjuna. They are in Mill Road and they have a three-day-a-week vacancy for a till worker. Now, this is for 4 months. It's covering maternity leave. And you can ask at the till for an application form. And now we go over to the wine bin.
News first of a change of date. The wine and dine evening at Robinson College is now on 20th July, celebrating English wine and wines and food. Tickets on their website.
On the 18th of July, a Rhone masterclass at Cambridge Cookery and Bistro off Hills Road. The wines are accompanied by small plates of matching food prepared at their award-winning kitchen. £45, tickets available from the Cambridge Cookery and Bistro website.
On to other news now. Tomorrow, as we heard earlier, there are free samples of food from Meatless at the Cambridge Gin Distillery showrooms in Grantchester. Various gin cocktails are on sale too. That's Sunday from 12 till 3pm.
Also tomorrow, there is a plant swap at Trumpington Allotments off Foster Road. And that is free and open to all. Give a small donation if you have nothing to swap. That's from 10:30 till 12:30 tomorrow. That's Sunday.
And some sad news now. Cobb's Bakery is closing. The final baking day is the 7th of July, and the reason is the ill health of Baker Allen, and we on Flavour wish him well.
We do.
Next Saturday is the Over Village Market from 10 to 12.30, where there is a good number of stalls, both food and others. It will include local fruit and veg, apple juice and honey, all from the excellent Bushel Box Farm in Willingham.
On the 13th of June, a talk and a tasting at the Cherry Hinton Road branch of Cambridge Wine Merchants from Uncle Val's Gin. Tickets from Eventbrite.
From the 22nd to the 24th of June at Wimpole Hall, there is the Wimpole History Festival. Plenty of food on offer from our favourite local street food vans.
If you're interested in trying some Japanese whiskey, there's a tasting with Stephanie Holt of Nika Whiskey at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road on the 27th of June. Cost is £15. Tickets are available online from the Eventbrite website.
And that's all for today. We're on alternate Saturdays at noon, repeated on Sunday at 2, and then podcast early in the next week.
And if you'd like to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or you can contact us on Twitter at flavour105.
Coming up next on Cambridge 105 Radio, Lee Chambers with Bookmark featuring debut novelist Sarah Marshall Ball.
So, goodbye. From Alan, Matt and myself, thanks very much for listening, and until the 23rd of June.
But before we do go, Sue, you brought some chocolates.
Oh, I have indeed some naughty chocolates, but they're not naughty. They're vegan marshmallows, and they're made with aquafaba, which is chickpea water. Do you want to try one?
I do.
I will. Oh, so yeah, that's...
Well, that's amazing.
Beautiful.
Good old chickpea water.
Mm. And it's clever my students. They won silver at a national award just this week. The eco-friendly food product
great
development.
Great stuff. Great.
Brilliant. Well, until next time. Goodbye.
Bye.